education at an elitist boarding school, while at the same time nurturing my ambition to become the welterweight champion of the world. It didn't take too many brains to figure out that world champion boxers are not spawned within a system designed to educate upper-middle-class Christian gentlemen. I placed less importance on my intelligence than on my prowess as a boxer. If the Prince of Wales School tried to disabuse me of my ambition to be the welterweight champion of the world, then the intellectual nourishment it might furnish as compensation would not be sufficient incentive for me to remain. But I wasn't about to let this happen. No more camouflage for PK. I would simply be the best. I hadn't discussed this with either Doc or Miss Bornstein. I was on my own again, and I had to do my own thinking. So when Jaime started on about beating the system, I knew immediately what he was on about. He passed me a stick of spearmint and commenced talking again. Now, my theory is that to beat any system, you have to know it intimately. Rebellion is senseless, and being pointedly different only leads to persecution. The only way to control any system is from the inside, the way the Jews have always done.
It didn't seem to help them with Hitler, I said. I didn't know much about the Jews in Nazi Germany, but Miss Bornstein had told me a little, and had added that old Mr. Bornstein actually felt guilty for escaping the Holocaust.
Aha, that was different. Hitler's Nazi party presented an impossible problem for the Jews of Germany. After all, you can't undermine a system from within when you're excluded from it in the first place, can you?
Jaime's point was not well made. I was to learn that he was obsessed with the Holocaust, that it sometimes clouded his otherwise excellent judgment. I could never quite understand why he possessed this obsession. His parents had escaped from Warsaw before the Jews were incarcerated in the ghetto, or were even unduly persecuted. Jaime had never known any real racial prejudice, yet he had a strong sense of alienation, as well as, it seemed to me at times, of guilt. Doc had taught me well, and I wasn't about to let Jaime get away with a cheap shot like that.
Every system tends to be mutually exclusive. They're all about keeping someone or something out. By keeping the Jews out of the Nazi party, Hitler was acting typically. No system wants to be undermined or abused, and therefore it is constantly on guard to exclude those who would destroy it. If, as you say, it is a common Jewish tactic to invade from within, then this should have been possible even with the Nazi party. We have to conclude that the Jews failed to defeat Hitler, failed to defeat the system, and as a consequence paid a terrible price. It wasn't an exception at all.
Jaime grinned.
Hey, you can think. I'm not used to that in a goy. Here, shake a paw.
I allowed the compliment and shook his hand, although I wasn't quite sure what he meant.
What's a goy?
A Christian, a Gentile.
Hey, can we be friends? I mean, proper friends, PK?
Sure, I said, not really meaning it.
You see, you're different. I know that now. And I'm certainly different, I always have been, but being a Jew at a school like this makes me even more so. I reckon we'll need each other.
What for? You mean to beat the system?
No, no, to use it. I've got a hunch we'll be a terrific combo.
I wasn't sure he was right. I still had a problem. While I had all the physical and intellectual equipment needed to succeed within the system, I lacked one thing. Money. The only way I could succeed without money was by being a loner. Friendship with this particular tribe of Christian gentlemen required resources. You were expected to pay your way. The only other way was by ingratiation, but I was damned if that was ever going to happen to me again. Perskop was still the dark shadow of PK, still alive in my mind. Come what may, I would never again stoop to conquer. Added to this was the fact that I was basically a loner. Other than Doc, and when I was small, Grandpa Chuck, I'd never been in the position of having a partner, and I'd never really had a best friend who was my own age. Having an immediate friend in this strange new environment sounded nice, but it also made me feel vulnerable.
"Have you honest and truly only got one name?"
Jaime asked suddenly.
"Well, sort of. You see, I've only ever used one name. One name is me."
"They won't let you get away with it, you know. The system can't handle things like that."
"It's just going to have to," I replied, sounding a lot braver than I really was. I longed suddenly to ask Doc what he would advise under the circumstances, though I already knew the answer.
He would simply have said that a man has the right to any name he wants to give himself. If a man is saddled with a name he didn't choose, how can he possibly be free for the rest of his life?
We got to be who we got to be, absolutely, he'd conclude after we had carefully and fully discussed the matter. Doc was not a man to make compromises on important issues, such as determining who a person really is in his own mind. I bet you're good at sport. Me, I'm rotten, Jaime said.
I'm okay.
What's your best sport? Jaime asked, humouring me. Rugby?
No, I box.
Jaime jerked back in his seat, plainly shocked.
You what? I'm a boxer.
Yeah, that's what I thought you said. Why, man, that's positively Neanderthal.
You could get badly hurt saying that to the wrong boxer, I grinned.
Jaime reeled back in mock terror. Careful, man, in a court of law, a boxer's hands are considered lethal weapons.
He was suddenly serious again. I tell you what, I'm a gambler and you're a boxer. That's yet another reason why you and I have to stick together, PK.
What do you gamble on? I asked. Jaime sighed. I'm a Jew. People expect Jews to be good with money, so what do Jews do? They oblige. My old man is filthy rich, and he'll give me all the money I need, but that's the very problem, you see. I have to make my own. It's an intellectual thing, not a greedy thing. I'm not really a gambler. Gamblers are stupid. Making money is simply a way of keeping myself mentally fit. Can you understand that?
No.
Are you rich, PK? I mean, your parents?
Hell no, I won a scholarship here. My mum's a dressmaker.
Well, that's why you don't understand. For me, money is like boxing is for you. It's my way of getting even with the world. For a rich Jew, money is a weapon. Unless I know how to make it on my own, I will be defenseless.
I was suddenly fascinated. It wasn't that Jaime's philosophy was the antithesis of all I'd been taught, although I knew the Lord was against money and definitely in favor of the poor. It was just that, well, Doc and Mrs. Boxall, or even Miss Bornstein, had never mentioned money or its importance in the scheme of things. I'd been forced into thinking about money for the first time when the list for my school clothes had arrived, and I had already worked out that not having any at a boarding school for the sons of the rich was pretty well going to shape my school career.
Are you very good at making money? I asked Jaime.
About as good as you at boxing, he replied.
You've got yourself a partner, Jaime. Money is something I have to learn about.
Jaime grinned.
It's a deal, Piqué. I had a feeling you were a bloody good boxer.
I was by nature a fairly quiet sort of guy, and had no trouble getting on with things. As a new boy, I was at the bottom of the heap, but was fortunate enough to be selected as the fag for the head of house, Fred Cooper, who was also the second prefect of the entire school, and the captain of the first 15 rugby. This immediately gave me some extra status amongst the other new boys, all of whom, like me, were allocated to a school or house prefect. Fagging was hard work, and we were on standby for the school and house prefects from first bell at 6 a.m. until lights out at 9:30. No chore was thought too menial, and a prefect had only to yell from his study, and all the fags within hearing distance would have to come running. Last new boy to arrive did the chore. In addition to this, each fag had a list of duties he was obliged to perform for his personal prefect. He made his bed, shone his shoes, cadet and rugby boots, washed his rugby togs, or during the summer, blankered his cricket boots, and if he was an officer in the cadet corps, polished his Sam Brown and brasses, laid out his clothes, tidied his study, ran his messages, and made trips to the tuck shop on his behalf. The first tanning I received was for scooping the tiniest dab of cream off the top of a cream bun I was delivering to Fred Cooper. At least it started with the tiniest scoop, and then, in an attempt to smooth the scooped part, I took one or two more small scoops on the end of my finger. By the time I arrived at Fred Cooper's study, the bun looked somewhat rearranged.
"You rotten little bugger, you've been knocking my cream bun!" Cooper yelled at me.
"My hand slipped over it, and I had to lick it off, sort of, sir," I explained, not quite willing to tell an outright lie.
"Shit, did you lick my bloody bun, PK?"
"No, sir, just my hand."
"Close the door, boy. We have an excellent way to train slippery hands."
Cooper reached for the cane, which hung behind the door.
"How many times do you reckon it slipped?" he asked.
"Not many, sir," I said fearfully.
"Not many is once or twice or three times. Tell me, man."
"Once," I said hopefully.
"Right, bend down."
I bent down, holding my knees, and proffered my arse.
Whack.
That's one for your slippery hand. Whack. That's one for your slippery tongue. Whack. And that's one for your poor memory.
Cooper returned the cane to the back of the door and pointed to the cream bun on his desk.
Eat it, and go and get me another one with your own money.
I stood looking at the cream bun with its shiny brown top and cream-filled center. This was my first major crisis.
I don't have any money, sir.
Cooper turned back to his book.
Use those slippery fingers of yours to find some, he said, dismissing me.
I left his study holding the offending cream bun gingerly in my hand. Pocket money was drawn every Wednesday after lunch and every Saturday morning, but as I hadn't been given any for the term, the fact that it was Tuesday meant two things. None of the other fags would have any money this late in the week, and even if I could borrow some, I had no possibility of paying it back. My arse stung like hell, but I hardly noticed it in my anxiety. Jaime Levy was waiting at the end of the corridor which led to the sixth form studies.
Christ, Pique, I could hear it from here. That bastard sure blasted arse.
I'm in deep shit, I told him. I've got to buy Cooper another cream bun, and I haven't got any money.
Jaime shrugged.
Easy, man, I'll give it to you.
Then he pointed to the bun in my hand.
What's that? That's a cream bun.
I explained to him what had happened.
Sorry, but I can only accept a loan if you'll let me do something to pay it off, I added.
Don't be stupid, PK. Pay me tomorrow after pocket money.
It was the first time I had had to admit that I had no money whatsoever.
You mean nothing? No money at all?
Jaime was clearly astonished. He dug into the change pocket of his grey flannels and produced a 2-shilling piece.
Here, take it. You can pay me back when you leave school.
Bullshit, Jaime. That's in 5 years.
Jaime grinned.
I'm a Jew, remember? We're supposed never to forget.
You're also a pain in the arse, Levy. Keep your 2 bob. I only need threepence anyway.
Bugger it. I'll go and throw myself on Cooper's mercy.
What, and get your bun blasted again? Give us that bun. Here, hold this.
He carefully lifted the top half of the bun and handed it to me. Then using his forefinger, he spread the cream from the center of the bottom half of the bun to the edges, piling the cream high on the edges. He held out his hand for the top and replaced it onto the bottom half, squeezing lightly with his forefinger and thumb to force both halves together. As he did this, the cream squirted out of the sides as natural-looking as you please. He handed the fully restored cream bun back to me, a satisfied grin on his mug.
"Gee, thanks, Jaime. I owe you, man," I said, relief flooding over me.
"Don't thank me, PK. It took 2,000 years of persecution by bastards like Cooper to make me smart. I really ought to thank him."
It was the first time we'd beaten the system, although of course it was Jaime who had really done so. After I'd given Cooper his new bun, we retired behind the bogs and laughed our heads off. Then Jaime took out his miniature chess set and we battled it out for the next hour. We were evenly matched players. His cunning was matched by my years of memorizing all Doc's games, plus my having a reasonable grasp of the niceties of the game. We were in the school first chess team right from the start, which wasn't earth-shattering news. The Christian gentlemen were not exactly breaking down the doors to join the chess club. Boxing presented a problem. It wasn't a major sport at school, and therefore not compulsory. Only about 20 boys out of the 600 in the school took part. Darby White, the gym master and ex-light heavyweight champion of the British Army, had turned 6 of these 20 into a fairly good boxing team, although I soon learned that we only boxed the Afrikaans schools, as the other English schools didn't go in for boxing. No other boxer in the school of any weight had been trained as well as I had been or came close to my skill. Sarge was also very keen on boxing, and he and Darby White would work the squad together. While the school team was said to be game, morale was pretty low when I arrived. The school had won only 6 individual bouts in 5 years, and none in the past 2 years, let alone a boxing match. The red, white, and green ribbon, which were the school colours, and which had been tied around the handle of a massive wooden spoon and hung from one of the beams in the gym, were beginning to fade, the spoon having been in permanent residence with the Prince of Wales School so long. Darby White would sometimes look up at it a little wistfully, and say, "I don't expect ever to win the school's trophy, but I'd just like to lose that dirty great wooden ladle for just 1 year." I told Jaime about this, and he immediately became interested.
Jaime's interest in sports was zero, but he couldn't resist an intellectual challenge.
"How good are the other chaps in the squad?" he asked.
I was forced to admit that they were pretty average. The kids in the prison squad back home could have taken them with one arm tied behind their backs.
"How good a coach is Darby White?"
Darby White wasn't Heel Pete, but he knew his boxing, and he was certainly as good as Captain Smith.
"I think he's lost his enthusiasm, but he seems to know his onions," I replied.
"You need a manager, and I know just the chap," Jaime said.
That was the nice part about Jaime. He never bragged, but he was absolutely certain of his superiority. It crapped a lot of people off, but Jaime had prepared himself for a life where the slings and arrows were fairly frequent, and he didn't seem to give a damn whether or not he was liked.
"Persecution is the major reason for a Jew to exist. If it didn't happen, we'd soon be as intellectually inferior as you lot," he'd say.
I asked Jaime how he proposed to turn possibly the weakest school boxing team in the world into a winning combination. He looked at me, and for once the slightly cynical grin left the corners of his mouth.
"We need only one winner for a start. One guy you can rely on to win. The rest is easy, the rest is only good management. When men can be made to hope, then they can be made to win."
He placed his hands, one on each of my shoulders.
"How many fights have you won in the ring, PK?"
34, I replied.
"How many have you lost?"
"Well, none," I said, a little embarrassed.
"You'll do nicely. There's nothing a gambler likes better than a certainty."
"This is the high felt. The standard is much higher than in the low felt where I've done all my boxing. Sooner or later every boxer gets beaten."
"Sure, sure, but let's do all we can to delay that moment as long as possible. PK, I smell money in that boxing team."
"You mean by becoming an integral part of the system? Me boxing and you managing and then making it work for us?"
"I love a fast learner," Jaime said. When Darby White and Sarge saw me work out, I could see they were enormously impressed.
"Where'd you learn to box, son?" Darby White asked.
Without thinking, I answered,
"In prison, sir."
It was a reply Darby White would never grow tired of recounting. To my often acute embarrassment, it became his favorite boxing story, and given the slightest opportunity, he'd recount it to the coaches from the other schools. Sarge was second in command of the boxing squad, and acted with Darby White as a second, or alone when Darby was refereeing a fight. As a young guardsman with the Coldstream Guards, he'd been quite a useful amateur in his day. Later he'd worked as a second under the famous English trainer Dutch Holland of the Thomas à Becket Gymnasium in South London. Dutch Holland was the best cut man in England, and Sarge claimed to have learnt the art of stemming an eye bleed from him. A cut eye would usually stop a fight in school boxing, which wasn't always fair, as the better boxer could lose on a TKO when he was ahead on points. Sarge could work miracles with a cut stick, cotton wool swabs, adrenaline and Vaseline. In fact, his special skill as a cut man was one of the weapons Jaime was to use in his campaign to lift the boxing squad out of last place in the school's competition. Jaime had himself elected as the manager of the boxing squad by the simple expedient of volunteering for the job. No first-form boy had previously held this job. The managers of the various major sports, cricket, rugby, swimming, shooting, and of course boxing, were invariably chosen from fifth-form boys, who, while not being sportsmen, were known to be brains. Hence these positions came to be known as SWAT spots, and the fifth-form boy honoured with a SWAT spot would invariably become a school prefect in the year following. However, the SWAT spot for boxing had become a school joke, and was therefore seen as not worthy of a brain. It was considered extremely poor form to apply for it, and Darby White had for the past 4 years rejected the few applicants on the basis of them not being known brains and therefore simple opportunists. In putting his case for the SWAT spot in boxing, Jaime pointed out to Darby White that as he was in the school's senior chess team, he qualified in the brain department, and besides, with a first-former in the job, Darby could look forward to 5 years of continuity with all the advantages of long-term planning. Jaime's arguments were persuasive, the most telling of them being that we couldn't do any worse than we were doing, so Darby might as well give him a go. Darby White only jingled his balls in his white duck trousers furiously for about 2 minutes before agreeing. Darby was quite unable to make a decision of any sort without putting both hands into his trouser pockets and giving his balls a tumble. The longer the process, the more complicated the decision. My first fight was as a flyweight. Although at 102 pounds, I was a very light one, and would be fighting a kid who weighed nearly 10 pounds more than me. It took place in the school gymnasium a month after the term had begun. Home matches drew little attention from anyone at the school. School spirit did not extend to boxing. It was a recognized fact that we always lost, and only the boxing squad and first-form boarders, conscripted to watch, would be present to see the tripe walloped out of the Prince of Wales team. These one-sided bouts were privately referred to as two-fisted attacks from the hairy backs, as in, another 7-0 two-fisted attack from the hairy backs. The malevolence between Afrikaans and English-speaking South Africans continued unabated, with the English still feeling mightily superior. The fact that only Afrikaans schools boxed was further reason to dismiss the boxing team as being somewhat déclassé and not worthy of the finer traditions of the school. Darby White, in his white ducks and singlet with his belly spilling over the old tie which held his trousers up, and Sarge, in his jazzy hotel doorman's uniform and silly pace stick, were looked upon as a comic opera team by the remainder of the mortar and gown teaching staff. Nothing was ever said, but you simply knew that those who laboured in the field were not equal to those who laboured in the mind. While only the handful of Prince of Wales kids attended that first fight, the gym was packed with kids from the opposition school, an Afrikaans high school named Help Makar, which translated into English means help each other. Help Makar enjoyed a huge reputation in all sport except cricket. Its boxing team was said to be the best in South Africa, and had won the South African school's boxing championships the year before. At 111 pounds, the kid I was fighting was just 1 pound short of being a bantamweight. I didn't mind, as I was used to fighting guys heavier and bigger than me, and had fought tougher-looking kids than him before. But Jaime was concerned. This was the first time we were going into business together, and at the weigh-in he'd looked worried.
10 pounds is a lot to give away. This Heldenhuis guy is supposed to be shit-hot.
Come on, Jaime. He's a new boy, just like us. How would they know? How's the book going?
Great, that's the problem. I've been taking bets in the toilet from the Help Makar chaps all night. And I've got you 10-1 against 4-1 on Heldenhuis. And they're falling over themselves to bet on their man.
That's great. Did you tell the first form boarders to bet on me?
Yeah, they're all pretty excited, but their bets aren't anywhere near enough to cover us if Heldenhuis wins.
Christ, Piquet, I must be mad.
It's not having all the facts that's pissing me off. We have no form on Heldenhuis. None on you, for that matter. We're making book in the dark. That's just plain dumb.
We've got to start somewhere. Let's start by trusting each other.
No offense, PK, but next time first the facts and then the trust.
It was perhaps the most important thing Jaime ever said to me. Jaime was the supreme example of Hoppy's dictum, first with the head and then with the heart. It was to be the basis of our business operations from that time on. Heldenhuis was solidly built around the shoulders, and I knew I'd have to stay away from his right, which he kept throwing straight from the shoulder as he shadowboxed while waiting for the fight to begin. Giel Piet had warned me that some boxers throw shadow punches before a fight to deceive their opponent into thinking they lead with a left or a right, when in actual fact it's the other way around. The idea is to surprise your opponent in the first few seconds, and so unsettle him. I studied the big kid and decided there wasn't any subterfuge in his shadowboxing. He was much too confident to bother with any tricks. His leading hand was the left, and I noticed he held his right too low, leaving his jaw unprotected. His slightly more open stance suggested that he saw himself as a fighter, in which case he would come out hard and fast, hoping to nail me early with a good punch. For my part, I would always just sit on the pot, as Giel Piet called sitting quietly on the tiny three-legged corner stool, waiting for the fight to begin.
"Tell them nothing, young," he had said. "Just sit and watch. Watch very carefully. I'm telling you, man, you can tell a lot about a boxer even before he throws a punch, if you watch him carefully."
The bell for the first round went, and after we'd touched gloves, the Help Makar kid came at me fast. He was hard-eyed, and I could sense he planned to make short work of the fight. I saw the first straight left coming from a mile off, and allowed it to miss the side of my head by a fraction. A near miss with the leading hand often gives a boxer the confidence to try again immediately with a similar punch. Thrown even harder than the first, it invariably throws the boxer slightly off balance. The second straight left came right on time, and as it whistled past my ear, his right dropped to the level of his chest, leaving his head wide open. I stepped in, and with my body slightly turned to maximize the power, the right hook I threw landed flush on the point of his chin. He was already off balance, moving into my punch, and he hit the canvas hard, sprawling on his back. While the blow carried all my strength behind it, it was also a perfectly timed punch, and a gasp went up from the Help McCarr crowd, while a wild cheer rose from our first form boarders. The kid on the canvas sat up as the ref began to count. There was no way I could have knocked him out, but he was clearly shaken. Young guys are too proud to stay down for the compulsory eight count, and he jumped to his feet, glowering at me. The surprise had been on the other foot, and I now expected him to move around me for a while, waiting for a chance to use his superior strength to nail me with a few solid blows to the head. "First you're going to have to catch me, you boor bastard," I thought. The referee went through the compulsory eight count, then wiped his gloves and told us to box on. I was so obviously lighter than the other kid, and now, looking into his eyes, I suddenly realized that he had regarded the blow as a fluke and had no intention of boxing smart. He moved straight at me again with his right still held too low. He was telegraphing the punch to come by watching the point of my chin. Christ, he's going to try the left lead again. As Gil Pete would say, "Some fighters you can read better than a book, but ach man, the story has no bloody imagination." The straight left came hard and missed, merely flicking my ear. I brought my right across his left and hit him on the side of the jaw, only just missing the point. I followed with a left hook into his solar plexus, and he sat down hard, the seat of his pants seeming to bounce as he hit the canvas. I cursed myself. You don't get too many chances for a really good right cross in a fight, and I hadn't set myself correctly. Nevertheless, it was a good punch, and the left had dug in just below the ribs where it really hurts. Heldenhuis was strong and game, and was back onto his feet in a second. He waited for the compulsory eight, and as the ref wiped his gloves, he warned him that one more knockdown meant the fight was over. I knew I'd have to be lucky to get a third crack at him, and decided it was time to box, to wear him down, jab, 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 waiting for the chance to come under his left lead, to land a series of solid punches under his heart. That way, if he wasn't enormously fit, I'd sap his stamina to give me another crack at him in the third and final round. The bell rang for the end of the round, and I returned to my corner to find Darby and Sarge grinning from ear to ear. In the second round, I simply boxed him. His style was exuberant, and I waited for him to grow impatient as I kept him at his distance with constant jabs to the face. Towards the end of the round, he must have realized that the fight was slipping away, and he seemed determined to knock me down, even if it meant taking a couple of punches on the way. He came at me with both hands swinging. I think he expected me to move away so that he could nail me in a corner. But I stood my ground and hit him with a straight left, which pushed him back against the ropes. I followed in with Gil Pete's eight-punch combination. Two good scoring shots to the head, one of which opened a cut above his eye. The next bang on the nose. One more into the cut, and the rest neatly placed under the heart. To my surprise, when the bell went for the end of round two, the Help McCarr guys gave me a round of applause. Heldenhuis didn't come out for the third round. The referee had examined the cut above his eye and stopped the fight. I'd won on a TKO, the first win for the Prince of Wales School in 2 years. It didn't seem to matter that we lost the other seven fights, although all lasted the distance. The boxing squad, generally outclassed, hadn't fought with such spirit and determination for years. Sarge was walking around, flashing his mouth full of gold teeth, and saying in a whisper that carried for yards, "Bloody marvellous! That ought to show those bloody boors who's boss!" You'd have thought we'd won the match. The boxing coach from Help McCarr came over and patted me on the back. "Who taught you to box, son?" he said in English. "I learnt in Barberton, Meneer," I replied in Afrikaans. He looked suddenly smug. "Machtig. I knew you were too good for an Englishman. I've never seen a kid your age throw an eight-punch combination. Come to think of it, I've never seen any kid throw an eight-punch combination. Who taught you to box, man?" "Meneer Gil Pete," I replied. "Well, I wish we had him at Help McCarr. That's all I can say, man." "I don't really think you would have wanted him," I replied, but he seemed not to hear me. "You're an Afrikaner. What are you doing in a school like this?" Without waiting for my answer, he continued,
Listen, we could arrange for you to come to help Makar. You'd be with your own people. We could organize a boarding scholarship.
I'm English. A Roynik, I said quietly. For the first time in my life, I felt enormously proud about something. Perhaps it was wrong to be proud, but I'd waited a long time to come to terms with being a Roynik. The coach from Help Makar looked at me for what seemed like a long time.
Well, you don't box like an Englishman. Don't desert your own kind, son. Englishmen don't talk Afrikaans the way you do, I know. I'm a language teacher as well as a boxing coach.
I am English, I replied in English. Honestly, sir.
Well, Englishman, I doubt there's a kid in your white division anywhere in South Africa who'd beat you. That is if this Roynik school doesn't bugger you up.
He turned away abruptly, walked over to where Darby White was standing, juggling his balls and looking pleased with himself. I could see they were both looking at me, and Darby White had a proprietorial grin on his face. I felt a hand on my shoulder, and I turned to see the big kid I'd fought. He wore a large pink elastoplast patch over his left eyebrow.
How's it?
He stuck his hand out.
Jannie Geldenhuis. No hard feelings, okay? You won fair and square, man,
he said in English with a thick Afrikaans accent. Thanks for the fight, I replied in Afrikaans as I shook his hand. He grinned and seemed pleased that I'd replied in Afrikaans.
Ach, man, I don't think I even hit you once. I've never done that before. It'll teach me a bloody good lesson. You looked like such a little bugger. I thought I had an easy fight on my hands.
I smiled at him. You're such a big bastard, I thought I was going to get a hiding. Gert had always said that a man should be magnanimous in victory, and Jannie Geldenhuis seemed like a nice bloke.
Yeah. That was the bloody trouble, man, so did I.
He grinned again.
Just you wait, man. I'll get you back on the rugby field. What posse you play?
Scrum half. By the way, my name's PK.
Yeah, I already know. Me too, I'm also scrum half. Alles van de beste, PK.
He turned to go and then turned back and rubbed the point of his jaw.
Jesus, you hit me a beauty in the beginning of the first round.
Then he went to join his schoolmate.
Yeah, so long, Jannie,
I said, pleased it had ended this well.
Jaime walked up just as Geldenhuis departed.
How's it? What did the hairy back want, your autograph?
Nothing, he just said no hard feelings. He'd see me on the rugger field. Jaime grinned.
I'll say no hard feelings, we're rich.
He frowned suddenly.
But we still got to hate the bastard.
Shit, Jaime, not after it's over, I said, grinning.
It may only have been a boxing match to you.
Jaime pointed to the wooden spoon hanging from the beam above our heads.
To me, it's the beginning of getting rid of that. We can only do that by learning to hate.
I sighed.
Jaime, you've got to learn there are good Boers and bad Boers, just like everyone else. You can't just lump them all together.
The only good Boer is a dead Boer, Jaime snorted.
The only good Kaffir is a dead Kaffir is where that came from, I said, chiding him for his lack of originality.
Yeah, them too, he added ruefully. Christ, Jaime, you're a Jew. How can you say things like that?
Jaime laughed.
I'm a very complicated Jew, he said. PK, if we're going to win against those Boers, we've got to learn to hate them. Don't you even understand the fundamentals?
Bullshit.
Yeah, it is. You're right. It is bullshit.
He looked at me and grinned again.
But for Christ's sake, don't tell the others. We've got them thinking they can win, that the enemy isn't invincible.
He was the only one on the boxing squad who hadn't congratulated me, and I wondered why. I was to learn that Jaime was the world's best persuader. He could pump courage and spirit into a dejected boxer, soothe his battered ego and recover his self-esteem. Jaime smoothed words on and gently massaged them in as though they were a magic balm. But he only used them this way for a predetermined purpose, and only with people he considered less than his equal. A light pat on the back was all I ever got. Jaime considered me his equal, and he allowed me to share his superior intellect, which was usually two or three jumps ahead of anyone else.
Well, tell me.
Tell you what?
Jaime asked.
How much? How much did we make?
Jaime grinned. Enough for you to buy Cooper several hundred cream buns if you ever have to again. I reckon we'll get a fiver out of it each.
Jesus, Jaime, that's wonderful.
It's only the beginning, PK. This time we gambled and won. Next time you fight, we're going to know the form. We're going to know everything it is possible to know about your opponent. Every time he scratches his bum, we're going to analyze why. The making of money should never be left to chance. After my solo victory against Help McCarr, Atherton, Cunning Spider, and Pissy Johnson immediately joined the boxing squad, along with 12 of the other new boys. It soon became apparent that Pissy Johnson was totally uncoordinated and would never make a boxer, but Atherton and Cunning Spider were natural athletes and quickly caught on. Jaime called the new boys the Wooden Spoon Goons, swore us all into an elaborate brotherhood, and elected himself president for life and me captain. Jaime knew the value of a little mystique. The initiation into the Wooden Spoon Goons involved the exchange of everyone's blood except his own. He swore each of us into the brotherhood and then instructed me to swear him in as president for life. He had personally composed the protocol for the ceremony, and when his turn came he handed me a slip of paper to read, which went like this. Do you, Jaime Solomon Levy, solemnly agree to fight with all your wit and skill and nerve to restore the Prince of Wales School to its former boxing glory? This came as somewhat of a surprise to all of us, as we had no idea there had been any former glory to restore us to. I do, Jaime said. Do you agree to act selflessly without thought of personal glory or gain as the president for life of the Wooden Spoon Goons? I wondered how he managed to reconcile this with our business arrangements. This I do solemnly declare to do, Jaime said in an impressive flourish of grammatical construction. In consideration for so doing, and in the year 1946, in the reign of His Gracious Majesty King George VI, I, P.K., Captain of the Wooden Spoon Goons, declare Jaime Solomon Levy President for Life. Jaime had confided to me in a rare moment of introspection that in naming him, his parents had thrown the whole bloody Polish ghetto at him. Why couldn't they have given me just one goy name, like Derek or Brian or Arthur or something? It was the only time I ever heard him question his Jewishness. Later, as we were walking back to Wellington, I ribbed him about the restoring us to our former glory bit in the swearing-in ceremony, and also mentioned the no personal gain clause in his oath as president for life. Jaime stopped and turned to face me. With an exaggerated sigh, as though he had seriously come to doubt my sagacity, he said, "Oh, for Christ's sake, PK, don't you read history? It doesn't matter how much of a crap-up a country makes, by the time it gets into history it's been turned into glorious tradition. It's the same with an institution. You can't go having the school losing on its boxing team generation after generation. History simply doesn't allow for that sort of truth. Of course we've got a glorious tradition, because if we haven't, we have now, and as Wooden Spoon Goons we're going to have to restore the Prince of Wales to its former glory, whatever the fuck happened in real life." Wow, as Doc would say. No doubtski aboutski, Jaime Levy was the absolute best. As for the personal gain, our primary purpose is to restore the school to its former boxing glory. There's no thought of not doing so if we can't make a quid out of it. That's what I mean by no thought of gain. We are not creating a business situation, we are merely exploiting one. Not to do so would be tantamount to sheer neglect. Almost criminal, if you ask me. There had been one strange happening at that first fight against Help McCarr. Sarge had approached Darby White just before the fight to say that about a dozen blacks, all very neatly dressed and very clean, were standing outside the gymnasium and wanted permission to come in and watch. Darby, with much juggling of his balls, was reluctant. If they were caught on the streets without a note from their employers, they would violate the pass laws, which put a 9 o'clock curfew on all Africans. He didn't want to have a run-in with what he referred to as the constabulary, which, if you have ever had any dealings with the South African police force, is a very benign way of describing one of the toughest paramilitary forces in the world. However, all the blacks showed him notes from their respective employers, and he finally allowed them to stand by the door with old Jimbo, the boot boy from schoolhouse, who hadn't missed a fight at the school for 20 years. The boxing coach from Hope McCarr came over and protested. and to our surprise, Darby replied that the boys, like old Jimbo, were school servants and welcome to stay. My fight was first, and after I had been given the decision over Jani Geldenhuis and the excitement had died down a bit, I looked up towards the door. Except for old Jimbo and a very tall man, the Africans were no longer there. Upon seeing me looking in his direction, the tall black man raised his hand in a clenched fist.
"Unashobishobi ingelosi,"
he shouted, and was gone.
"What the hell was that all about?"
Sarge said, looking up from cutting the tape on my gloves.
"Sounded like some sort of war cry. Ungrateful blighters, they've all gone home after the first fight."
It was the first appearance of the people. At first, my black fan club, as it was to become known, was only a dozen or so. But when the venue permitted it, it would grow to several hundred, and later a great deal more than that. The legend of the Tadpole Angel was spreading. After a few weeks, it became obvious that my identity had somehow been revealed to the school servants through the same weird osmosis in Africa that makes news penetrate prison walls, travel over mountains and into the townships, until it becomes a part of the very air itself. And so a subtle change began to take place. The best cuts of meat appeared on the junior's table, and seconds were always brought first to where I sat. I found that my chores had been taken over. I would go to Fred Cooper's locker to get his rugby gear out for washing or his cricket boots for cleaning, only to find that they'd been done. His Sam Brown and brasses always shone like a mirror, and even the laces in his rugby boots were washed. Only the morning chores, such as making Cooper's bed, were left to me, as there were no dormitory servants around first thing in the morning. My own gear was always spotless, and back in my locker, clean or polished, by the time we got back to Wellington from the main school each day for lunch. On one occasion, my football jersey had been ripped. I had made a hopeless job attempting to repair it, and it concerned me greatly. I knew with certainty that my mother could not afford to replace it. I arrived back at Wellington for lunch, to find that it had been neatly machine-darned, washed and ironed, and was as good as new. I spoke often to the school servants in their own languages, but they never for one moment admitted to anything. They had heard the legend, knew the myth, and had simply reacted without needing direction from anyone. In fact, I knew there would be no interested party looking after me, no concerned group of ex-prisoners. Africans don't work like that. Each simply acted out his feelings, responding to what he or she felt. The legend of Unashobishobi Ingelosi was sufficient in itself. It fed off my presence, and not because of anything I would consciously do. In fact, despite my desire to do so, there was nothing I could do to stop it. My boxing was the needed proof of my status as a warrior, and the fact that I only fought the hated Boer yet another. As is so often the case with a legend, every incident has two possible interpretations, the plausible and the one which is molded to suit the making of the myth. Man is a romantic at heart and will always put aside dull, plodding reason for the excitement of an enigma. As Doc had pointed out, mystery, not logic, is what gives us hope and keeps us believing in a force greater than our own insignificance. The boarders put my privileged position down to my near-fraternal attitude to the school servants, which nicely explained their anxiety to help me. I was beginning to understand, a natural leader. And leaders, I have found, need never explain. In fact, the less they explain, the more desirable they become as leaders. Except Doc, I had never been given to explaining myself, and this was taken as strength by those who followed me. In truth, my reluctance to share my feelings was born out of my fear as a small child, when I had been the only Roenick in the foreign land of Afrikanerdom. I had survived by passing as unnoticed as possible, by anticipating the next move against me, by being prepared when the shit hit the fan to take it in my stride, pretending not to be hurt or humiliated. I had learnt early that silence is better than sycophancy, that silence breeds guilt in other people. That it is fun to persecute a pig because it squeals. No fun at all to beat an animal when it does not cry out. I had long since built the walls around my ego, which only the most persistent person would ever manage to climb. 18. I was the youngest kid in the first form, but what with one thing and another, I was clearly seen to have a bright future at the Prince of Wales School. My boxing win had made me a hero amongst the first form boarders, who, elated by the financial gain from betting on me, had become devoted fans, and who now exaggerated the fight in their constant retelling of it to any of the day boys who cared to listen. The next two matches had been away from the school, and these I had also won, and the boarders had once again shared in the spoils. Although we didn't have enough information on the two boxers I fought, my opponents were comparatively easy, and as both had been beaten by Heldenhuis, we took the chance of giving the Afrikaans punters more than attractive odds to back their own fighter, with the result that we turned both matches into nice little earners. The retelling of these two fights, by Jaime in particular, made them out to be gladiatorial bouts which made the first fight against Jani Heldenhuis seem like a kissing match. By the time the next home match took place, there was standing room only in the school gym, and the 50 or so Africans who had turned up were obliged to watch the fight through the large bay windows. To the delight of the school crowd, I won what turned out to be an easy fight. The other kid was very aggressive, prepared to take any sort of punishment to get a punch in. He was said to have won his first three fights inside the distance. But he came at me wide open on three occasions in the first round, and I sat him on his pants in the middle of the ring three times. Three knockdowns was all it took to win a fight. The school was further vindicated when our light heavyweight, Danny Polkinghorne, won on points in a brawling but thrilling three-rounder. Jaime and I had started a register on every boxer the school fought against, in every weight division. I would sit with him during a fight and describe the opponent fighting one of our boxers. I would talk about his footwork and his style, his weaknesses or strengths in ringcraft, and his personality in the ring. I would point out those boxers who dominated the space they boxed in as if they owned the ring, and those who seemed to be fighting in borrowed space. We would separate the stand-up fighters from the boxers. We would note those who cut easily around the eyes. Jaime would jot down every punch thrown in a fight, how many and what they were. Our notes would end with my summary of the entire fight and of the boxer, noting the punches he liked to throw the most and how many he threw during a fight. Boxers were obliged to weigh in before stepping into the ring, and Jaime would record their fighting weight and compare it with the next time they fought. We kept all these records in a big leather-bound accounting book, on the cover of which was embossed in gold, Levy's Carpet Emporium, 126 Church Street, Pretoria, Carpet Fit for a Prince. In this book, written in Jaime's neat, already mature handwriting, we would add to a boxer's profile every time he fought against the Prince of Wales School. In a remarkably short time, Jaime began to grasp the niceties of boxing. While I could remember the most minute details of almost every fighter, Jaime quickly developed the ability to anticipate with uncanny precision the way a boxer would fight the next time he appeared in the ring. He had an unerring instinct for a boxer's weakness, and so we were able to prepare our own boxers to fight an opponent to exploit these. Of course, it also allowed us to set the odds on a fight with a high degree of success. Business was booming, for while the Prince of Wales boxers were still regular losers, the odds we offered meant our losses were well contained, and that after a short while we could usually depend on one or two wins to pick up the big money. After the first year, when we had boxed every school twice and I was still unbeaten, it became difficult to get a bet against me. The Afrikaans kids weren't fools, and we were forced to offer more and more attractive odds on my opponent, to the point where we were taking unnecessary risks, and it was beginning to put me under pressure. In a fight against Heldenhuis towards the end of the second year, where the odds were 20-1 on Heldenhuis beating me, I only narrowly won on points. The Afrikaners had wised up. Profits were down. With our juniors beginning to win, they could no longer hedge their bets against me by taking shorter odds on some of the other fighters. Jaime decided it was time to quit the bookmaking business. "It's time to get out, PK. There are two important rules of business, knowing when to get in and when to get out. Of the two, knowing when to get out is the most important. We've got bigger fish to fry." I'd enjoyed 2 years of regular pocket money, and I didn't relish the prospect of being broke again. "These fish we are going to fry, what are they?" "I'm buggered if I know," Jaime said. "But something will come along. Business is simply a matter of opportunity and money.
If you've got the capital, sure as tomorrow is Tuesday, an opportunity will come along.
We built up a considerable bank over the first 2 years. 50% of everything we made went into our capital, which was earning interest in the Yeovil branch of Barclays Bank. That's when I had the idea.
Jaime, we've got 50 quid in the bank, and we're getting 2.5% on our money, which isn't very much. I mean, £1.10 a year, it's nice, but it isn't world-shattering.
Jaime laughed.
There was a time not so long ago.
I cut in. Yeah, I know, £1.10 was a lot of money, more than I'd ever owned. But listen, pocket money's on Wednesday and Saturday. By Tuesday and Friday, everyone's broke.
We were sitting on a bench under the oak trees, bordering the cricket field, and Jaime jumped up in alarm. I could see he was upset, and he leant over me and gripped the back of the bench on either side of me.
PK, are you crazy? Don't you understand? I'm the token Jew around here. What the fuck do you think the Christian gentlemen are going to say? A moneylender? Me? Christ, PK, the whole purpose of my education at this goy school is so that sort of stigma can be removed from my Jewishness. I'm here for the politics and the polish. I've already had several 100 years training in usury.
That's all the banks do, isn't it? I replied.
If you want to loan from a bank, you've got to go cap in hand. And they don't even have to earn it in the first place. People just give it to them for a lousy 2.5% interest. And they then turn around and lend it for 7%. That's nearly 200% profit. That isn't usury?
PK, you don't understand. When the banks do it, it's business. When a Jew does it, it's exploitation.
I see. So a Jew can't own a bank?
Of course he can. Rothschild, one of the world's most famous banks, is owned by a Jewish family. The Rothschilds are one of France and England's most respected families.
Yeah, I know, I said. They started in Frankfurt-on-Main in Germany towards the end of the 18th century as moneylenders.
Christ, PK, I don't need to do this. There are other ways to make a quid. You'll see.
Jaime was clearly distressed.
In the meantime, you can borrow from our capital for pocket money.
You don't need to do this, but I do. I'm not going to use our capital. I can earn my own way. I'm sorry if I've hurt your sensibilities, Jaime, but I've climbed into the ring 25 times in the last 2 years to support our bookmaking business. It's your turn now.
Jaime released the bench and straightened up, clasping his hands behind his back as though he was preparing to give me a lecture.
Do you know why I really came to the Prince of Wales School, PK?
He didn't wait for my answer before continuing.
Let me tell you. When the Prince of Wales, I mean the then future king, came to Pretoria, there was a reception held for him by the Red Cross. My old man supplied the red carpet for the occasion. The deal was free carpet for an invitation. He stood in a line and the prince shook his hand. He never quite got over it. It was as though he'd touched the face of the Almighty. He'd made it. He'd reached the social pinnacle. He was a gentleman at last. A gentleman with a heavy Polish accent, but a gentleman no less. He bought his own carpet back from the Red Cross for a huge sum and carpeted the lounge room at home. I don't think one day of my life went by without at least one mention of the fucking carpet.
A prince already with his own feet walked on that carpet, my boy,
Jaime mimicked. Then he read in the paper that there was a Prince of Wales school in Johannesburg and that the prince was to lay a wreath at the school's war memorial. He decided that if he had a son, he would bring him up as the perfect English gentleman. Correction, perfect Jewish English gentleman. This school and Oxford to follow is going to make me the first respectable Jew in our family since Moses bawled in the bulrushes. I'll tell you something, PK. If he had to carpet every classroom, all 3 boarders' houses, and the school quad to get me in here, he'd have thought it was a bargain.
What you're saying is that by becoming moneylenders, we fuck up everything.
Jaime grinned.
Yep, that's about it.
Well then, we'll call it a bank.
Look, Jaime, it meets every criterion we've established for business.
There is a known need for our services. The risk factor is small and easy to control. Our creditors can hardly default, can they? We don't have to borrow capital, and the profits are reasonable and regular. As Doc would say, no doubtsky aboutsky. It's perfect and it's honest. Well, sort of.
What will you do if I say no? Jaime asked.
I find it very difficult to come to terms with your answer. Now let me tell you a story. The guy who taught me boxing was a Cape Coloured and by any standards a bad bastard. He'd spent more time in prison than out on the street. He was the worst kind of recidivist.
By any standards, the scum of society, he lied, cheated, and robbed. He'd also been beaten up more times than you and I have had hot breakfasts. He is the ultimate loser. That's how the world saw him. That's how they judged him.
You're talking about Giel Piet, aren't you? Jaime said.
Yeah, well, Giel Piet was just about the best friend I ever had. He died for me. A warder named Borman rammed a 2-foot baton up his arse until he hemorrhaged to death. Giel Piet could have saved himself simply by confessing that it was me who smuggled the prisoner's mail into the prison, but he didn't. I didn't see him as any of the things he was supposed to be. I saw him as one of the best human beings I am ever likely to know. Christ, Jaime, it's not what a man does, it's what a man is that counts.
We called it the Borders Bank, but it simply became known as the Bank, and was an immediate success. Interest was at 10% per week, and loans were never extended beyond a fortnight, which was long enough for any kid to write home for money if he got himself into a financial fix. In the 4 years we remained at the school, we didn't incur a single bad debt. The funny thing was that not only the boarders, but also the day boys, regarded the bank as a valued institution. Moreover, Jaime's antecedents never entered into it, although the bank formed the basis for some of his more spectacular future financial ploys. I could say our spectacular successes, but Jaime was the real wizard, and I remained the sorcerer's apprentice. The bank also formed the basis for my pocket money, a source of great personal pride to me. I'd solved the major emotional problem confronting my school career, and unencumbered with money problems, was now free to forge ahead. By the time we had reached Form 3, the younger boxers were beginning to win on a regular basis, and Atherton and Cunning Spider had each won 6 of their last 7 fights. Atherton as a lightweight, and Cunning Spider as a light welterweight. Jaime's wooden spoon goons were building a reputation, and gaining a whole heap of respect from the Afrikaans schools. The Prince of Wales school was no longer a joke, and the Boer War was often won by the English these days. That was the year we finally lost the wooden spoon, and the faded green, red, and dirty white ribbon was removed, and replaced with the colours of another school. Jaime had achieved his first objective, which he told the wooden spoon goons was only a small pimple on the great hairy arse of my ambition for the gentleman Christian boxers. In the 3 years it took to lose the wooden spoon, I earned an exaggerated reputation as a boxer amongst the Afrikaans schools on the Witwatersrand. I started to fill out, and by the time I was 14, I was fighting as a bantamweight. Every fight, at school or away, was attracting the people. A match 100 miles by bus or train from the school would attract just as many Africans as one at home when the boxing bouts had been moved away from the gym to the school hall. Here the Africans were allowed to sit at the very back of the hall, separated from the whites by a wide corridor. During the summer it was popular to have the boxing out of doors, usually with the ring set up on a rugby field. At these times the blacks would be allowed to watch the fights, even those held at the most racist Afrikaans schools, where they were kept well separated from the white spectators. It was at one of these out-of-town Afrikaans schools that I first heard the word apartheid, used to describe the place where the black spectators were allowed to sit, and I have often since wondered if I had witnessed the first use of a word which would become universal as an expression of oppression. The boxing matches at these outdoor venues usually started at 6, just as the sun was beginning to set, and were all over by 8 when it was still light enough on the Highveld not to need lights over the ring. It was at another of these outdoor fights that we invented the famous sun blinder. The Prince of Wales boxer simply used the ring so that his opponent could be turned to face into the setting sun, which would momentarily blind him. The idea was to work an opponent round, and then time a punch just as the hapless boxer moved into the direct line of the late afternoon sun. If a boxer was clever enough on his feet, this simple expedient could be made to work 6 times during a fight, often earning the extra points required to get the decision. The gentlemen Christians had no compunction about doing this to their opponents. After all, this was the Boer War, and no quarter was given or expected. Jaime got the idea from a movie he had seen,
which showed how the Battle of Britain Spitfires had come out of the sun to pounce on unsuspecting German aircraft. The people would watch the fights in silence until it was my turn to fight, and then invariably a soft, almost